We good to go? Sure. Ich ni san chi go ruku sichi hachi ku ju. In Japanese for you that time, Smile. Thinking back to my martial arts days.
You know, you really taught me there. Like, I'm not coming up with anything better than Japanese.
What he said.
Yeah. I'm not coming up with anything better than Japanese.
Talking about martial arts training days, yo.
I can't even count to 10 in Hebrew.
Welcome to a special edition of 31 Thoughts, the podcast, brought to you by the next generation GMC Sierra Denali. Elliot, this is really indeed a special one, and someone that I've admired for a number of years. We've known through his work by way of publications like Behind the Moves, which is a book that I put in that category of every hockey fan must read. If you want a snapshot of what the NHL is like, what hockey is like, this is what hockey is like from the GM's perspective. I don't know if you're like this. Like, I have a list of books that I think everybody should read if you're a hockey fan. They Call Me Gump is one, the book written by the late Lauren Gump Worsley. That's one of them. Ken Dryden's The Game, which was revolutionary when it came out. And I put Behind the Moves in that category as well.
Net worth is in that list to me.
Net worth,
but
for sure.
I don't think if you're a member of the media, you can do your job without at least reading that book once.
Yep.
And I'm sure you're like me. You refer to it several times.
Yep.
You're always looking, especially whenever someone makes a trade or they're going through a tough time, you're looking for history. So that's one thing, but I would agree with you. I think it's a book that has to be on every reporter's and every sophisticated fan's bookshelf. And I think even if you consider yourself like just someone who is a fan, there's good stories in there that you'll really like.
Yeah. We're talking about Jason Ferris, former executive VP of the Dallas Stars, author as well. Still a member of the Society for International Hockey Research. Are you still a card-carrying member of my club, Jason?
I am for 25 years, what my wife affectionately refers to as Nerdfest.
Yeah, I get that a lot from my wife, too. We get the little mini trumpets whenever I mention that.
Well, if the shoe fits, you got to wear it, right?
It does. First of all, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, guys.
Pleasure to have you aboard. Want to talk about your new project, but really quickly, since, listen, on this podcast, because Elliot works, I don't want to say in concert with GMs, but he finds out information about general managers and how teams operate. A lot of this podcast revolves around, let's have a look under the hood and see how decisions are made and see what's really happening. A lot of it is treated as power topics, who's on top, who's on the bottom. That's sort of one of the overriding themes of this podcast. The previous book here, Behind the Moves, talks a lot about that. Can you give us a couple words on, for those that might not be familiar with Behind the Moves, a quick snapshot from your point of view on what this is? Elliot and I can talk about why it's important, mm-hmm. but from the author's point of view, what is this?
Well, it was done in 2011, and it was done hand-in-hand with the participation of the 35 at the time living general managers who've taken a team to a Stanley Cup final. And we did over 120 hours of interviews with them. But really what I engaged with them was leadership conversations. And so the book Behind the Moves is really, in the GM's words, what they were trying to accomplish, the challenges that they saw that they faced, and then the other 34 guys talking about what it was like interacting and dealing with that GM. Mm-hmm. So it really does, you know, give you kind of that access behind the velvet curtain of what goes on in that sort of secret society of GMs. And both, it gives you a history of the guys at the time Milt Schmidt was living, who had been a GM in the 60s, all the way up to Stan Bowman and some of the more recent guys. So it gives you a nice history, but it also presents thematically a number of topics that GMs face, trade deadlines, scouting and drafting, dealing with ownership, managing up, dealing with the media. And you have each of these 35 guys kind of weighing in from their perspective. And so I think that's what was unique about it, is it really is in their words and them off the clock, thinking thoughtfully about their career and the challenges that they faced.
You know, the one thing I took out from that book is, I think it's Bob Clark who says it, that if you're a guy who you make a trade with someone and you screw them over, whether it's an injury or some detail that you didn't tell them that they mm-hmm. should have known, everybody finds out quickly and you become a pariah. That's the story I remember the most. I don't know if there's one you remember
the
most.
But that changed. Right. Once upon a time, and Brian Brook talks about this, once upon a time there were pirates, and you knew that if you shook hands with Sam Pollock, you had to count your fingers afterwards, because that was that level of competition. And then somewhere along the way, that changed, when transactions had to be good for you and good for me. We're protecting our reputations amongst each other and amongst the entire group. It wasn't always that way.
Well, I don't buy that it's changed. You look at Major League Baseball, there was a big scandal a couple of years ago where the GM of the Padres was caught keeping a separate injury database aside from the one that everybody could kind of see. Mm-hmm. So I still do think if you want to take advantage of the system, you can. But if you get caught,
yeah,
you're in big trouble.
Three-way deals is another example of that. You know, a guy doesn't want a player to end up in his conference or in his division, and some of the engineers a three-way deal. And there's a lot of thought that has to go in before you do a three-way deal, what level of disclosure you're going to give. So there's lots of those kind of challenges that GMs face.
I was really surprised, Jason, that it took so long for someone to do this. I mean, Dick Irvin would write, you know, wonderful books about coaches. Behind the Bench is a common theme because Craig Custance wrote one as well about coaches going through some significant games in various coaches' careers and walking through them after sitting with them and watching the video. So coaching books have been written, certainly player books have been written. Why do you think it took so long for a GM book to be written?
Well, because it's a secret society. I mean, they keep to themselves. Not only had a book not been written, there were no stats for the GM. So as part of the Behind the Moves, we compiled the stats for, at that time, the 167 GMs who had been a GM. And like the coaches and the players, now they've got their own stat book, right? So it was really a large project to try and properly document, as Brian Burke and I talked about, the profession of general management. And it is a profession, and I think it's treated that way. And so, you know, hopefully that book honors that.
Do you think the art of it has been diminished? With salary caps and salary caps within salary caps and the way that, you know, you're – hands are tied, whether it's by way of the CBA or ownership, part is being lost.
Yeah, I think so. And I think also back in the day, you know, in the John Ziegler era, you know, the GMs ran the league to a large extent. And so, and it was a smaller group. There were 16 to 21 of them, you know, and it was a smaller group, and they all socialized and whatnot and had each other's back, but also were trying to beat each other. So things have changed. Expansion has caused that. Certainly the CBA, the opening of Europe, all these different things have changed. And now, you know, you've got guys that are having to manage far-flung staffs. You know, Pat Quinn used to have a secretary, you know, and then he coached him, GM'd, and that was it, right? And now you've got far-flung scouting staffs and development groups and all these kinds of things.
So let's go on to the new project. So this is a really interesting. You have interviewed how many players?
25 plus players,
25 plus players from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and more recent.
Guys that retired, even just a couple years ago.
And you have asked them to pick a team.
Correct.
Of guys they played with.
Correct.
And there is a salary cap. You can't put Wayne Gretzky on the fourth line.
Correct.
And you had to pick guys you played with from a certain year you played with them.
Correct.
All right, I'm done asking questions. You take over. You explain what you've done.
This is the latest book. It'll be out in the fall, but we're going to pre-sell it here starting in April. And the book is called It Takes 23 to Win, Building and Being Part of Great Hockey Teams. And the thought process behind it is, I'm interested in, you know, all 23 pieces and parts that go into a winning team. I'm interested in not just the starting goaltender and the, you know, star right winger, but I'm interested in the third line and the, you know, 14th forward and the second pair of defensemen. And so, you know, if people like Behind the Moves, which really kind of pulled back the curtain on the GM suite, as it were, this is a book that really seeks to pull back the curtain on the dressing room and allows fans to kind of go inside the dressing room with, in this case, we've picked 23 players, four from the 60s and 70s, four from the 70s, 80s, all the way up. So you've got a nice range of years. I've picked 23 guys, each at the proper position that they played. So I've got a true fourth line center. I've got a true, you know, checking winger and et cetera, backup goaltender. Each of the guys played over 500 games in the league, and they each played in four more places. So they've all had 250-plus NHL teammates. So they've been in a lot of places. And, I gave them the constraints of picking a team of teammates, but I wanted a real team. I don't want an all-star team. I didn't want the all-time greatest team and all that. I want a real team of players. And so the two constraints they were given, like GMs, they've got a salary cap. They've got to pick a teammate who played at the position he played while he played with you. So you can't have Wayne Gretzky, as you say, on your fourth line. You got to have a true fourth liner. And then the second thing is you've got limited free agency. Not everyone's available to you. So you might have played in Detroit on some great teams for 3 years, but then you played on some pretty bad teams. So you have to pick one guy off each team you played on. So you get this wonderful diversity of teams. So I've got, the 23-man unit that I picked, and then that spawned 23 more teams. So we've got 24 teams. We've created kind of a fantasy little league.
Who judged your league?
So There is only one guy who, or three guys, I should say, since 67 who've won a cup as a player and as a head coach. And Terry Crisp is one of those guys. And Terry Crisp was a ton of fun. So, but he played in the 60s and 70s. He coached in the 80s and 90s. And he's a broadcaster in the 2000s and, you know, still today part of the Nashville broadcast. So he's seen all these generations of players. So we put them 24 teams into two conferences. You know, four missed the playoffs on each side. We had a 16-team bracket and he played them down and basically handicapped each of the series to the point where we get to a finals. And again, you're thinking about inter-era conglomerations of teams. It's a lot of fun. And then he's sort of talked about how he would have played that lineup in the finals, who we would have matched up against one another. And then, you know, we'll leave it to the fans to decide who's going to win it. But I think it's a lot of fun. And like Behind the Moves, each of these players has not only picked 23 teammates, but they have weighed in with a story or an anecdote or something that was exemplary about that guy in their own words. So this is a book in the words of the players, not something fancy written by me.
So does the book include Terry's contact information so the players who picked teams he said didn't even make the playoffs could reach him and say, Terry, what is this BS?
Well, and just to be clear, Terry had teams blind. He didn't know who had picked them, so there's none of that insider stuff. But yeah, I mean, I feel a little badly. I got to go talk to these guys, and you know, a few of them didn't make the cut. But you know what? I chalk it up to injuries, or you know, a goaltender that went cold, or something like that. You know, they've all got their outs.
As all of us curious about roster construction, this sounds like a fascinating project to me. Brian Burke told me once that his preseason speech to his hockey teams is always the same, and it's a common one, and people have added to it. And he would say, and walk in and say, who's been to the symphony? And a couple of guys would put their hands up. Most wouldn't. And he'd say, well, here's what happens at the symphony. All the musicians come out one by one. And first violin comes out last. And the spotlight is on her. She walks slowly. She's wearing a beautiful dress. Everyone is watching her. She's the star. That's the reason most people came to the symphony. And in the back, there's a guy like me holding a tuba.
Yeah.
But the music doesn't start until both of us sit down. Right. To which I think it was Lou Lamoriello added an adjunct to it, which is, and then the conductor turns his back to the audience and faces his team. How do you determine? I'm curious about that. You know, the tuba player and the first violinist. But sometimes players over the course of their career can start off as the first violin and end up tuba. You look at a player like Steve Yzerman, who for a long time was first line center. By the end of his career, mainly due to injury, ended up playing a bottom six role, at times fourth line center. Denny Savard, 85, is different than Denny Savard, 93, with the Montreal Canadiens.
Right.
How do you determine where that player is for what you're doing in this project?
Right. And so the guys, they pick teammates. And that's a really good point, because each of them picked a guy at an age. And so somebody might have picked, pick a name, Al Secord, as a young Boston Bruin, as a 19-year-old who played on the third line. Al Secord clearly was a first-line player, you know, by the time he got to Chicago. But as a 19-year-old, if he picked him, that's where he was. Similarly, yeah, Igor Larionov might have been chosen as a 39-year-old playing as a third-line center. Clearly, he could have been a number one center in the prime of his career. So that's kind of what's interesting about this, is you get these players that have been chosen at the time that the player who picked them was with them. And what you really find is the teams that these players have chosen, I say assembled, not picked, because they've got an abundance of riches to choose from. So they're assembling a unit, and it really becomes a fingerprint of themselves in three regards. First of all, it's a wonderful reflection of the era they played in. The style of players they're picking are the guys they have to choose from that played in the era that they did. It's a fingerprint of who they played for. Some guys played for some pretty bad teams. So the depth of players they have to choose from at certain positions is not great. And then lastly, it really is a reflection of what the individual player valued. What type of player did he value? And so each of these teams that emerges really is an interesting thumbprint of the guys who chose them. And you find that all players have a bit of GM in them. They're all sitting in the room. If I was starting a team, I would start with that guy. I would want this guy as my wingman, you know. So they all have that notion, but then you have to put the constraints like the GMs have, that you can't have everybody. And it's interesting how they kind of navigated their way through that.
Now, can you give us some names of who picked?
Well,
you got to give us something.
What do you want?
So tell us, give us four guys who picked a team.
This book is about the pieces and parts of teams.
But I think people would be interested to know who you went to that picked.
No, I understand. But what I'm saying is, you know, rather than give you first line, let me give you the third line of this team that I've picked that have then gone on and chosen a team. So we got Scott Gomez, who's the center,
okay.
And played in the 2000, 2010s, obviously. Wilf Paymont is the right winger.
Uh-huh.
Good, sturdy, up and down, you know, got a little finesse. And then Al Secord, who I mentioned, is the left winger there.
So right? Al Secord, Scott Gomez, and Wilf Paymont are all in your book, having picked a team.
Having picked a team, yeah, from the teams that they played for. Al Secord played in Boston, Chicago, Toronto, and Philadelphia. Scotty Gomez played in New Jersey, Rangers, Montreal, San Jose, you know, St. Louis, Ottawa. You know, so you've got Wilf Paymont played in Kansas City, played in Colorado.
In
right?
Toronto,
played
yeah.
In Toronto, played Quebec in
Quebec City.
Right?
Yeah.
So the guys that I've chosen represent the eras. They all have, every team is represented in terms of a player, and they've all, like I say, had been in four or more rooms and had 250 teammates to choose from. So kind of a really rich thing. There's over 500 players that ended up getting selected for whom we now have a wonderful oral history from a teammate talking about what made that person tick, or a fun story in the room that kind of gets to the role that he played on that team, whether he was a star or not a star.
How did you do this? Like, I'm curious about the research, because obviously you had to pick 23 guys.
Yes, it's a jig. It was and a jigsaw puzzle
to,
for sure.
Then you had to figure out if these 23 guys would do this with you.
And you know what? To their credit, every guy that I've went, and we've got four Hall of Famers, we've got I think 12 Cup winners. I mean, they're real guys, but we've also got a seventh defenseman and a 14th forward that, you know, although they played 500 games in the league, were up and down between the AHL. It's a nice reflection of the league. You know, there were two guys that didn't want to do it, and one for a very good reason.
They?
I'm not going to.
Come
not
on.
No.
Tell us.
No, because. But
his name rhymes with.
And none of these guys, you know, what I say is focus on the guys who they all chose. Don't focus on the ones that weren't picked.
Right.
Because a lot of thought went into this. And at the end of it, the universal response from the guys was that was a ton of fun seeing the names from the guys that I played with and really thinking hard about how I would put a team together. And, you know, there's a lot of guys in here that, you know, they worked me hard. Oh, come on, he's not a first-line center. He's a second-line center. And, you know, the competitive side really came out on these guys. It was a lot of fun.
That's a great question. I was hoping you got there, because one of my favorite things about talking to hockey players about other hockey players is how blunt they are.
Mm-hmm.
And even blunt about themselves. I can remember after his career wrapped up, Bobby Holik and I driving to go see an Oshawa Generals game. He came to visit, and we hung out for a few days and went to see a Generals game. We were driving, and I said, Bobby, how come it didn't work out for you with the New York Rangers? I mean, wonderful contract. I mean, set you and your family up for life. But you were a different player with the Rangers than you were with the New Jersey Devils. And he said, Jeff, it's like this. If Bobby Holik is your third-line center, we're going to win the Stanley Cup. Bobby Holik is your first-line center, we're not going to win the Stanley Cup.
Right.
I love it when guys are blunt about themselves.
Right.
How blunt were the guys in your book about themselves?
Well, it was exactly like behind the moves. I mean, I think one thing I'm able to do is sort of get people to a place where they are real. And I think the guys have been real. I mean, there's some guys, like behind the moves. Behind the Moves was 278 pages, I think. There were two pages that were anonymous. Everything else had a name associated with it. And we did that to purposely show, you know, not every situation is perfect.
Yep.
Well, same thing here. And there's one guy that said, because I asked him, you know, not all teams are right. Like, think of a bad situation and where it went sour and what crept into the room that made it that way. He goes, it was me. He goes, I was a selfish player at that point. You know, I wouldn't have wanted to be a teammate. And he kind of goes into all that. So it's quite interesting. I think they're comfortable talking about the teams that they were on, you know, and the players that they played with. They don't like talking about people that they didn't play with and speculating on this and that, but they're quite, I think, thoughtful and respectful of the teams they played on because they're proud of them. And there's a lot of really good insight here. So, you know, it takes 23 to win. That's the name of the book, and that's what you find. You're right. The third line center is as important, and that's what's unique about our sport.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't take a point guard and a big tall center. It doesn't take a quarterback and one, you know, a great running back. All 23 guys have their name on a cup, and there's a reason, because all 23 of them are needed down the road at some point.
Is there a wink at international hockey?
Yes, there's so what we've just described in terms of the player picking teams is takes about 140 pages of the book, and just so fans can see, each player's 23 man lineup is laid out with their 23 hockey cards from when they played. So there's a really neat kind of nostalgia piece to it, I think. But there are other sections to the book. There's a section on international hockey where we've looked at the full lineups of two Canada teams, 76 team and the 02 team, a couple Russian teams, a Finn, a Czech, a Swede, and an American team, and where we've looked at the leadership groups of those teams, and, you know, guys have weighed in about a challenge that they faced in a short international tournament and how leadership handled that challenge.
Yeah. So, does the name Jan Suchy come up at all for Czech?
No.
Not at all? The Czechoslovakian Bobby Orr? No.
No, no. We looked at the 98 team, and a couple of guys off that team weighed in and talked about the leadership group there, Reichel and Jager, but also the role Ivan Holinka played on that team, kind of diffusing a potential situation between two star players, Jager and Reichel, and basically, you know, giving the C to an older Ruzicka player and then kind of diffusing that. So it's an interesting kind of angle.
That sounds like you two are fighting. None of you get to play with
exactly.
this toy.
Exactly. That's right. So then there's a
I've used that technique before.
But you've only got one kid.
Yeah, camp counselor.
Oh, I see. Got it. Then there's a Stanley Cup section. There's 12 franchises that have won multiple cups since 1960, and so we pick one team off out of each of those franchises, two from each decade. And in that case, we look at an exemplary piece of each team. Chicago 2013, we look at Oduya and Chalmerson as an exemplary second pair behind Keith and Seabrook, for instance. And so we use that to kind of examine different pieces and parts of teams. And then there's a section on recent rivalries of Canada-US where we look at sledge teams from both Canada and the U.S. and a couple of top women's teams from Canada and the U.S. with some of the key participants there. So I think fans are going to get a real inside look at teams, the construction of teams, the dynamics of teams, where teams live in the room, at the bench, and on the road. There's a piece there. We look at, there's a section on advanced analytics and what the Washington Capitals got out of each lineup position in their run last year. So
how did you do that? Did you work in concert with someone, or is that
An NHL scout who's I respect highly, who's very stitched in. You know, he's got a good scouting eye, but he also has a real sense for the analytics side of things. He's kind of that bridge of generations, and so he's taken a look at, not just from a cap standpoint, but from an on-ice performance standpoint, what did the third-line right winger contribute, and what did they get out of that third pair of defensemen? And so I think fans will find that interesting in terms of, and whether it's face-offs, whether it's, zone penetration time, whether it's, puck control, whatever. They're getting different things out of different players. And, what did a team like the Capitals, who won it all, what did they get versus, the rest of the league?
Was there much?
I assume you're not going to tell us who that scout is either.
No, I think he'll remain quiet.
This is terrible. You won't tell us anything.
Well, the book. So we're going to pre-sale the book,
and
we're going to do that. It's on sale now at 23towin.com.
Yeah.
And part proceeds of the pre-sale are going to go to the NHL alumni and help both their hardship fund, but hopefully maybe put a little towards the concussion research work that they're helping spearhead as well. So I hope fans will go and check that out there. The book will ship in the fall. But like all my books, I print them once and then they're done. So, hopefully this will be well received, and I'll be off to doing other things, and people can enjoy it next fall when it comes out.
I mean, I'm curious about weight of competition. A couple of obvious examples, World War II hockey players, right? Oh, this guy's a World War II hockey player. He didn't go in fights. So he racked up big points while a lot of the star players were off fighting. Or if you look at post-1967 NHL, the league doubles, it's watered down, there's a couple of years of expansion, 70-72, here comes the WHA. You can make the argument that is when the NHL was at its weakest point. I don't know what you do with statistics, what you do with Stanley Cup winners and all that, but some people look at that era in our Society for International Hockey Research can look at that era and say, well, you won this and you did that, but that's when the league was at its weakest point. Does that get a nod, or are you someone that looks at that quality of competition in that era and says, that wasn't when the league was at its strongest, so I'm going to devalue that era a little bit more than this era when the league was at more of a strength position?
Well, this book isn't really me weighing in on who's good and who's bad. This is the players talking about it. And so I think by picking four players out of the 60s and 70s, four out of the 70s, 80s, four out of the 80s, 90s, you've got a representation of the league, the ups and the downs of the league.
Okay, let me try a different angle.
Yeah.
As someone who follows it historically as closely as you do you buy that argument?
Well, I guess I buy that the best players of the day then would be the best players today. And, I think it's all relative.
It's been one of the arguments against Bobby Orr.
Yeah.
Any argument against Bobby Orr is a terrible argument.
I loved Bobby Orr too, but just to be honest too, that is when the NHL was at its weakest.
I look at Tampa Bay this year, and to be 20 plus points ahead as we, at the end of the season, that's remarkable, because you have to judge yourself against the peers of your time.
Yeah.
And Bobby Orr against the peers of his time was
the best.
Head and shoulders above everybody else playing.
Great players could play in any era.
Yeah, they could.
And that's the end of that argument.
Elliot likes snuffing out my arguments fast. You should have seen him on TV Wednesday the way he snuffed out my Carey Price injury or getting injured, pulling him out.
That was a terrible idea.
Shut that down fast last night, Jason.
As Jeff mentioned off the top, you were executive vice president of Dallas Stars. You are currently an unrestricted free agent.
I am, yes.
And are you looking to get back in?
Absolutely. I think, you know, once you've had a taste, you know, we did some great things in 7 years in Dallas, and, you know, I'm looking for that next opportunity. And, you know, now's the time of year when front offices are changing and shaking up. There'll be opportunity. So we'll see. And in the meantime, I stay active in the hockey world, both with the alumni and through projects like this, which really get me to meet and talk with great people and explore different parts of the game. And in doing so, I'm able to kind of, open a window for fans to come in and see that as well. And I think get some access that they wouldn't otherwise have.
This is a pleasure.
Looking forward to it.
Well, 23towin.com is the only place you'll be able to get it. It's none of my books have been available in stores. They're all available online. And as I say, fans that order here in April will, part of their contribution will go to the NHL alumni. And fans will also get a kind of a fun composite illustration of the 23-man team that has been assembled, which will be a limited thing only for people that order in pre-sales.
Now, Jason is obviously limited in what he will say. Jeff, you and I have seen like small bits and pieces.
Yeah, it looks fantastic.
The transcript.
It looks really good. Just sort of lays out like behind the moves as well.
Yeah.
Which was, as far as a page turner goes, was, to your point earlier, full of information, mm-hmm. behind the scenes stories, and very readable.
Yeah.
And easy to read.
And there's lots of, my books are very visual, and this one is certainly that. And if you've got all the hockey card spreads and you've got some wonderful imagery and things that haven't been seen for a long time, artifacts and whatnot. So I think fans will.
Does it come with a poster like behind the moves?
Well,
which
as
is
I
great
say,
to have my wall in my office.
As
by
I
the
say,
way.
You know, fans that order in a kind of pre-sales will get a limited edition composite illustration of the 23-man unit with all the players, and it's kind of a fun piece.
Jason just held up a picture, which doesn't really work in the podcasting format, but I will say it's a good-looking photo.
Yeah.
Poster.
There you go.
Awesome. Jason, thanks so much for stopping by. Really, best of luck with the project.
Thanks, guys, very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason.
Thoughts is brought to you by the next generation GMC Sierra Denali, complete with the world's first six-function multi-pro tailgate. Nets sliding around on the way to pond hockey use the built-in load stop to help keep them in place. Loading what seems like half a team's worth of bags, the tailgate also turns into a step for easier access and has an inner gate that flips down for unloading all the gear you can fit. GMC Sierra Denali. We are professional grade. That website is 23towin.com. I get a lot of time for Jason Ferris and people like him. Creative thinker, outside the box thinker. The Behind the Moves book, Elliot, to me, is one of those books that, and it's hard to find now, unfortunately, for people, that needs to be on every hockey fan's shelf, or at least if you have a buddy that has it, borrow
it,
and read it. Steal it's even better. Theft, we always encourage here on this podcast. And 23towin.com, the website again. That book looks fantastic and follows, you know, that thought pattern of Jason Ferris, who just doesn't look at one thing and say, okay, that's the way it is. It's more along the lines of there's a lot of different ways to look at things. Let's find as many as possible. And he does it with this book, By the Sounds of Things.
Yeah, make us think. It's a great way to live. It's a great way to be. I really enjoy the way he does it. And the thing that it's obvious is that people trust him, right? They
yes.
talk to him.
Well, the GM's book proved that.
Yes.
When it first came out, I said, well, how did you get all of these people to talk? And I think getting buy-in from Brian Burke was probably
yes.
the on-ramp to a lot of it.
Yes, and people trust him. And if people trust you, they'll give you that extra nugget, they'll give you that extra story, and they'll make it better. And I'm looking forward to seeing what he comes up with.
Back in the NHL one day?
He'll be back in. Like, there's always room for smart people, right? And mm-hmm. he's obviously a smart guy. And, you know, what's power now? One of the most powerful currencies is information. And this is somebody who knows how to get information.
And look at things from a different point of view. So thank you to Jason Ferris for making himself available for this podcast. I like when we do these special ones with introducing hockey fans to people that they may not otherwise know. And Jason Ferris is definitely one of those guys. Taking us out is Dartmouth, Nova Scotia-based artist Adam Baldwin. Just released his third record, No Rest for the Wicked. And from that album, as we bid you good day, this is Salvation by Adam Baldwin on 31 Thoughts, the podcast.